Hello, welcome to the House of Comments podcast. This is a regular podcast featuring myself, Lib Dem blogger Mark Thompson, and also regularly featuring Emma Burnell, Labour blogger. Good evening, Emma.
Hi, Mark.
Hi. And just before we introduce the guest for this evening, I just want to apologise for having missed last week. We did intend to do one, but illness struck down both of us on two separate days. So one day Emma didn't feel up to it. And then the next day when Emma did feel she could just about do it, I was ill. And then in the end, we just thought, nah, it's not going to happen this week. But I think there's plenty to talk about this week, so hopefully we'll make up for lost ground. And I'd also like to welcome our guest this evening, Ellie Mae O'Hagan, who writes for The Guardian and also works for Unite the Union, although she's talking here in a personal capacity tonight. Good evening, Ellie.
Hi.
Hi. Okay, so we thought we'd start by talking about, it's actually quite difficult to choose what's been the biggest story of the last few days, but and actually I still find it surprising that this story is still less than a week old. It feels like it's been rumbling on for a very long time, but it's Chris Huhne, who has now resigned as MP for Eastleigh. He's taken the office of the Chiltern Hundreds, or the other one, the Manor of Northstead. I haven't kept track of which one it is, but he's got one of them. And he is no longer MP for Eastleigh, and there's going to be a by-election. So who wants to start us off? Ellie, what do you think about this?
The whole shebang or the by-election?
Yeah, let's talk about the whole shebang.
Well, I'm quite torn, really. My instinct really is to just feel quite sad about the whole situation because, you know, a lot of personal details have come out about Chris Huhne's relationship with his wife and his son. Details that probably didn't need to be shared in the public domain, but they were. And I think it just feels like a very sad situation where a lot of people have been hurt and a lot of people have lashed out and hurt each other. And Chris Huhne has obviously made a lot of mistakes, and he's a very flawed man, and he seems to have done some selfish things and irresponsible things. But it's hard. I found it hard to feel angry or any sense of glee about it, as some members of the right-wing press have, because it just seems like quite sad, really, that so many people have come out of it hurt, and that's really what I felt about it so far.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I mean, I'm no fan of Chris Huhne. I'm no fan of his brand of hubris, which I think you wrote quite well about this week, Mark. But I mean, I saw those text messages, and my heart just broke for Peter Huhne, who's never asked to be in the public eye. You know, he's a 20-year-old lad who's coping with the breakup, a very, very nasty bit of breakup between his parents. And that's nobody's business but theirs. And, you know, that the public examination of the damage being done to that poor guy is not going to help anyone heal.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. And I do wonder a little bit as to what's happened about all the post-Leveson, you know, newspapers and reporters are going to be more careful in future, because I really cannot see what the texts between a child and his father about something as tragic as this are in the public interest. They might be of interest to the public, but they're not in the public interest. Okay, the court might have needed to hear them, although actually, in the end, did they need to hear them? Because he pleaded guilty.
I mean, the wife's trial.
Oh, OK, yeah, well, fair enough. But at the same time, I really don't see why they need to be publicised so widely. I mean, I did write about Chris Huhne's hubris. I don't think there's any other word for it. I think that it is, I think I wrote, it's the literal definition of a tragedy, in that
tragic hero.
Well, the supreme self-confidence that saw him be able to rise as high as he did, you know, first of all, getting selected as an MEP, and then getting elected as an MEP, getting selected as an MP, getting elected as an MP, all of those things, that's a long, hard slog. You've got to have the hide of a rhino, especially in the Lib Dems, because we've got so many fewer seats. And then to actually get to cabinet level and to be one of the most tenacious ministers, respected and even feared by quite a lot of his colleagues, both Conservative and Lib Dem alike, to reach that point required a lot of self-confidence. But the flip side of that is obviously this hubris that ultimately led to his downfall. He thought he could lie. He thought he could bluff it out. And ultimately, he was trying to pervert the course of justice. And at the 11th hour, it's all fallen apart. And, you know, he deserves to go to prison now. He really does. You know, you can't do that and get away with it and expect to just be able to sidle off. And as much as I regret it, he will forever be spoken in the same terms as Jeffrey Archer and Jonathan Aitken. You know, it really pains me to say that because I was a big fan of Chris Hume. I still admire what he achieved, and you know, but it's just so sad to see what's happened. And over 3 points speeding. I mean, it's so pathetic in the end. You know what the original crime, and yet it's the cover up, isn't it? It's a classic Nixon type situation, isn't it? It's not the original crime; it's the cover up. It's absolutely terrible.
I think it's insane that he thought he could get away with it. I mean, he must have known. There must have been a long period of time where he knew that it was just a matter of time.
Well, no, I don't think so. I think he thought he had gotten away with it because it happened in 2003, and it wasn't until 2010, 2011 that whispers started, rumours going around that this had happened. And it seems to be that because his marriage ended, then that was the trigger for, you know, for this information to start coming out. We've got to be careful what we say. His wife's still on trial. She is pleading not guilty. So we probably need to not go into the details on that side of things. But I do think that he thought that this was dead and buried and gone. And actually, I mean, I was quite surprised to hear this because I personally would not do this. I just wouldn't. I just wouldn't. It just would not be worth it. You know, the risk of being seen to pervert the course of justice to save a few points on your license just seems silly to me. But apparently 300,000 people a year do this. That's a statistic I heard on the radio the other day. I read an article by Rachel Johnson today, who said she was at some do last year or the year before when the rumours of this first came out. And a number of women of very senior public figure men openly admitted that they had taken points for their husbands, and it just seemed to be a kind of the done thing, you know, that the husbands were on 9 points, they didn't want to lose the license, so they just took the points for them. There seemed to be no shame about it, so it does seem to happen quite a lot, but you know, that doesn't excuse what he's done, and you know, he deserves to go to prison.
Speeding is the crime, well, not me, but only because I don't drive, but I think speeding is the crime that everybody commits. I mean, I don't think I know a single person who hasn't gone too fast, faster than is legal. And I think, you know, I think it's sort of treated as not a very, even though it is obviously, it's actually quite a serious offence because, you know, the reason you have speeding laws is to prevent fatalities. But I think it is viewed in the public eye as being not a very serious thing to do. Maybe taking speeding points off your spouse is sort of, you know, maybe if you've got a casual attitude about the crime in the first place, then assuming responsibility for it isn't a big deal. But I wanted to say about the Leveson report that you just mentioned, that we're living in a post-Leveson Britain now and that the press should be responsible. Not that I want to deviate, but I think if you look at the way that the press handled the Sandy Hook tragedy a few months ago, I think it's quite clear that nothing has changed. I think the press is locked in an arms race to get the most detail, the most sensation, and to be the first with the exclusive. And I don't think that any report by any senior figure in politics is going to change that, to be honest.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. And there was a certain element of weary irony when I said it, because I knew as soon as the paper started saying, oh, yeah, we'll sort ourselves out, and Cameron backed away from any kind of statute, I just did status quo. We're back to the same as it always was. And that isn't going to change. Well, maybe, you know, if Labour get in at the next election and Ned Miliband sticks to his guns, maybe it will change. But to be honest, I think in 2.5 years' time, he'll have bigger fish to fry, and he won't want to push this. So, but before we get dragged onto Leveson, which we have covered on other podcasts, maybe we talk a little bit just about the Eastleigh by-election, which obviously the Hume resignation has actually triggered. Who do we think is going to win? Emma, who do you reckon?
Oh, I don't know. By-elections are always fun. I think the Lib Dems are probably favourite just because they're so organised in that constituency. They have, I think, all the council seats. They have 40 out of 44 council seats within the council, all of which fall in the Eastleigh by-elections, Eastleigh constituency. They have every single council seat there.
I believe that's right, yeah.
It's one of the few areas in the entire country where their vote went up rather than down during the PCC elections and the local elections. So if the Lib Dems are going to win anywhere, or hold on, and I think they will hold on in certain places, Eastleigh would be the kind of place you'd expect them to do so. If they lose, that really is devastating. More devastating than a lot of people are expecting it to be.
OK, well, in a minute, I'll play the part of the Lib Dem MP sitting on the election night panel. But but before we get to that, Ellie, what do you think?
I agree with Emma. I think people don't... I don't think that the Hune saga has tainted the Lib Dems. I think it's tainted Hune, but I think they've remained pretty much immune to it. I don't, because there's no evidence that it extended beyond him and his family, or that anyone in the party was covering up for him. Or I think it's a situation that's obviously blighted his reputation to the point of where it won't be recovered, but I don't think that it's actually affected the reputation of the party itself. So I think if they put forward another candidate that stands on a platform of honesty or whatever, I think that they'll be fine.
Yeah, the Lib Dems have actually already chosen the candidate. He's a local businessman who's been a councillor for a few years, and I think he's been a member of the party for 20 years. So I think Ian Dale blogged and described him as Mr. Charisma, which I've not met him yet, but I am intending to go down and help out at some point in the next week or two, so maybe I will meet him. Just in terms of what might happen, I think if I was pressed, I'd probably say the Lib Dems will hold it, but I would be reluctant to put any money on that, because I agree with you, Emma, that by-elections can be very unpredictable. And the Tories weren't that far behind last time, and they're going to throw the kitchen sink at this. I think we're already seeing them doing that. Although, there was a very interesting report that I heard on the radio today, which was that Norman Smith, BBC political correspondent, was in Eastleigh, and he was trying to get an interview with Maria Hutchings, who is the Tory candidate. And they just wouldn't let her be interviewed.
She's an absolute nightmare.
Only
Cameron can find himself a by-election that he might win, the first since 1982 for the Conservatives, and for it still to be a personal nightmare for him because his candidate hates him.
First since 1982, didn't William Hague win one in 1989? Sorry to become the amateur sophologist.
Everything I've read has been 1982.
No, Hague won in 1989 in Richmond, I'm pretty sure. But yeah, it's been a long time. You're absolutely right about that. In terms of Cameron, I mean, I guess he kind of felt like his hands were tied. I mean, she was the candidate, I guess, she's before 2010. I guess she still was. I don't know what internal rules the Tories have about re-selection, or whether just by default it goes through on the nod. But I know the Lib Dems have special rules where if it's a by-election, then, you know, special circumstances can kick in and they can pick someone who's by-election ready. And I just don't think she is. If they're steering her away from the cameras and the microphones so much, maybe she just will be a disaster, and that's why they're doing it.
I don't think the problem they've got is not that she's a disaster for the Tory voters of Eastleigh, but that she's a disaster for David Cameron.
Well, I think...
There are two different factors there, one of which might be quite attractive to the Tory voters of Eastleigh, but less so to Tory High Command and getting her on the radio.
But the reason why Tory High Command would be fearful of that is because of the focus on the comments that she makes, and ultimately if that reflects badly on the Conservatives, then it could help them to lose the air war, which in by-elections is actually very important, because there's so much focus and quite a lot of people who will be voting will be getting a lot of their information filtered through the media, because there's going to be so much of it in the next couple of weeks. So yeah, I would go for the Lib Dems, but one thing that I have been slightly surprised about is that Labour haven't been pushing harder here. I remember back in the 90s and even more recently, Lib Dems would often come from nowhere in by-elections and take the seat because they were in opposition and they were able to exploit, you know, the fact that they were in opposition and the fact the government was unpopular. I'd have thought this was an opportunity for Labour to really try and do that. And the feeling I'm getting is that they're not going all out.
Certainly not the feeling I've been given, to be honest with you. I think the sense that I get from Labour is, let's absolutely throw the kitchen sink at it. We're massive, like, outsiders. So if we don't win, we've lost nothing. But let's absolutely do it.
That's exactly the point. They haven't got anything to lose.
Conversations that are happening around who the candidates might be. There's a huge, huge trip down there today with loads of activists. They're selecting the candidate on Tuesday. So it may be that until there's naturally a candidate in place, it won't feel like that. But
has Ed Miliband visited Eastleigh?
I don't think Ed's been down, no.
I think that's always a sign, because he visited Corby, didn't he?
He visited court, but I don't think he'll go down until there's a candidate for him to introduce.
Yeah, it would be a bit odd if he just goes down there and starts wandering around. I agree with that. I mean, I'm pleased to hear, if you're right, Emma, that Labour are going to throw the kitchen sink at it, because, you know, I want this to be a genuinely competitive contest. And actually, the better Labour do, the worse it is for the Lib Dems, really. So, you know,
yeah.
From a tactical point of view, I should probably be hoping they play it low-key, But no, you know, I think that it's a by-election, and, you know, from a political perspective, I want to see it fought as well as it can be. And, you know, it could be a very interesting proxy for what's going to happen in 2 and a bit years. You know, we're in the second half of the parliament now. In terms of whether it would be a disaster if the Lib Dems lost it, again, it's difficult to say because of the fact that by-elections can be very unpredictable. But I guess we'll see. Are you planning to go down to Eastleigh to knock on some doors?
I don't know if I can get there, but I'll be going to head office to do the phone thing.
Okay, all right.
I'm not really a big canvasser for the Labour Party.
Okay, all right.
I did canvass for Ken in London, but other than that, I'm not really a...
Okay, fair enough. Okay, well, maybe we'll move on from that one then. I guess we'll come back to that over the next couple of weeks as the campaign intensifies, and then obviously we'll know the result pretty soon because it's on the 28th, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, okay. So the next thing that we thought we'd talk about was the report into Mid Staffordshire NHS with the horrendous things that happened there, and between 400 and 1200 people who they think otherwise might not have died actually did die, and some of them in, you know, appalling pain and appalling circumstances. I mean, I guess most people listening to this will have read some of the details of it and probably won't go into a lot of it now. But in terms of what happens next, what do we think about this? Emma, what are your thoughts on this?
I think it's just such a mess, and I don't think the things that are happening now are going to make it less messy. I think part of, from what I can see, part of the problem was that there was just no line of accountability that people understood, that people knew. I report to X, X reports to Y, Y reports to, you know, all the way up to Secretary of State and all the way back down to everyone on the wards. And I find the way that things are being managed out, both under the last government and possibly accelerated with the Health and Social Care Bill, parceled into these pockets of responsibility that have no connection with each other. My fear is that this is the tip of the iceberg, and that the iceberg is going to keep going for a really long time until we actually have a system that is fully reintegrated.
What do you think, Ellie?
I mean, I'd agree with that. I feel quite strongly about this because I think there's been... I should say that my mum is an NHS nurse, so I feel as though at least in one hospital I have quite a lot of insight as to what it's like to be a nurse in the NHS. And my concern with this story is that, and I wrote about this recently for The Guardian, is that if you look at an organisation like the Royal Bank of Scotland, when all of that happened, when, you know, when there was the bailout, then Fred Goodwin was kind of demonised as the problem, and he was immediately got rid of. When this happened with the Mid-Staffs Hospital, it was seen as, you know, a symbol of something that's happening in every hospital across the country. And everyone starts talking about, you know, compassion and care standards. And David Cameron says that nurses should be paid according to the amount of compassion that they offer, as though that's even a measurable thing anyway. And I just feel that, you know, not to detract what the families have experienced who had relatives in that hospital, because obviously some of the things that happened were atrocious. But I do feel that this is being used by a government that is very hostile to the NHS, that wants to privatise it, used to argue that there is a problem, an endemic problem in the NHS across the board, that standards that are declining, that compassion is no longer present in the NHS, and that it's not something that's worth saving anymore. And, you know, it's laying the groundwork for their reforms. And it means that there's going to be less impetus to fight against cuts, which I think is really dangerous, because I think that the reforms that this government is proposing, which do consist of a huge amount of cuts, will make things like this much more common. I think that's the problem. And I think it's really, you know, incumbent on the left to really fight against that.
I mean, I have a number of thoughts about this. I mean, the first one, from a personal perspective, is that in the last 18 months, well, from September 2011 through until July 2012, I spent about two-thirds of my time in six different hospitals with a member of my family who was very ill. I'm not going to go into the details of that now, but it meant that I had a lot of exposure to a lot of different hospitals in different places as well. So they weren't just all under the same primary care trust. Some were in London and some were near where we live, and one was actually down in Southampton as well, and another one was in Chertsey. And I saw a lot of good practice. I also saw on occasion bad practice. In my personal experience, the bad practice seemed to be not all the time, because some of the agency nurses were really good, but when things weren't so good, it was always the agency nurses. So that's just from a personal perspective. And I know, you know, anecdotal data isn't worth very much, but it's something that's quite close to my heart. And if anything like had happened at Stafford had happened, well, we wouldn't have allowed it to, because we were with the member of my family virtually the entire time. So, you know, we were very on top of what was going on. From the political perspective, I mean, it would be very easy for me to... I don't really think that this has happened very much, even, you know, by more senior politicians of, you know, the Tories and the Lib Dems, to point the finger at Labour, because this happened, you know, the report is reporting on a period between 2005 and 2008. And the report did mention targets. And obviously, targets was something that, you know, Labour did push quite a lot in that period. But I don't think that's very useful. And I also don't think it's particularly helpful in any way, because I think problems have happened with the NHS for many, many years. I've struggled to remember something that was as horrendous as this, but then maybe my memory just isn't working properly, because I know there have been reports in the past of really bad things happening. And I think what I would like to see happen here is perhaps a recognition that basically the people, the various health secretaries and the various governments that we've had over the years, I don't think any particular government does want to destroy the NHS or privatise the NHS.
I totally disagree with regard to this.
Moment. Okay, hang on. I really don't. First of all, the reason why I don't think this current government is trying to do that or wants to do that is because they won't get away with it. The public, and actually, I think we'll need to also define our terms here as to what we mean by privatisation, because what I'm talking about is, you know, the NHS being free at the point of use, and maybe some services will be run by private organisations, but they will report, and, you know, they will be controlled by the public sector and ultimately paid for by the public sector. And, you know, the idea that the NHS is just going to be sold off and that suddenly people aren't going to be able to, you know, go to hospitals and all of this stuff, for me, that just, you know, that just doesn't
seem... That's not the only way that privatisation happens, though, is it? That's not what people are saying are going to happen with these reforms. What is going to happen with these reforms is that it's going to be a very gradual process where the NHS almost privatises itself, because that's what the reforms are structured to do. They're structured to put a lot of weight on private companies winning contracts over the NHS until the NHS just becomes a husk of what it was. And people are forced to use private services because they tend to be much more reliable, because the NHS will be so underfunded. And you know what frustrates me about this whole argument of free at the point of use as opposed to publicly owned, is I would really love to see one example of an essential service being privatised and it being run better as a result. Because when I look at, you know, the railways or the energy companies in this country, and even like the phone networks, I don't see any cheaper, more efficient services result of privatisation.
I would totally agree with you about energy. And yeah, I would totally agree with you about the railways. I would totally disagree with you about telecoms. I remember when British Telecom was in existence, just about, I mean, I was a kid, but, you know, I know how long it took to get telephone lines installed. And the idea that the massive technological advances that we've had in the last, you know, 20 years in telecoms, I used to work in telecoms, you know, but after it had been privatised, you know, I know what kind of innovation was going on there. The idea that that would have happened if it had still been owned by the state and you still had to go down to the post office and fill out a form and wait for 3 months to get a phone line installed.
Where technology was at the time. I don't think that's anything to do with privatisation. And I think if you look at the rising cost of phone contracts, I mean, we're deviating now, but I just don't think there's a case for privatising essential services. I've just not seen any evidence that it actually... Who does it benefit? You know, there's an energy company called SSE Energy, and the CEO of that energy company was awarded a £2 million bonus 2 weeks ago, and yet people are suffering from fuel poverty in this country. I just don't think there's any evidence of privatisation of essential services being good for the public. They're good for the people who own the services, they're not good for the public. And I think it's the same with the NHS. I think if you privatise those services, it might be free at the point of use, but is it good for the public?
Okay,
Probably not.
Well, again, coming back to my own personal experience, there were various medical services that we had to call upon, all of which were paid for by the NHS, so we never had to pay for anything ourselves, but some of them were provided by private companies and some of them were provided for by, you know, NHS-run parts of organisations. And I have to say, in my personal experience, that the private company that we dealt with for certain items was more efficient than the NHS part. But again, that's just my own personal experience, but what I'm saying is that this, it's not an absolutely black and white clear cut thing. And what I would actually like,
but hang on, Mark, because this isn't just about within one service, the NHS and the private companies competing. What this is about is the breakup of different aspects of the services, sending those out to lots of different providers, so that company A, who thinks, okay, well, this bit's nice and easy, I can get lots of money for doing as little work as possible, I'll just take that little bit, and what you leave are the hard bits, the bits that aren't profitable, and that's left in the hands of that very core husk that's left of the NHS. So of course that bit looks less efficient because it's dealing with the most complex bits that are left over.
Okay, I want to come to a bit of a broader point on this, which I've sort of tried to touch upon. I'll try and touch upon it again. I think the NHS is too politicised. It is too easy for either side to throw brickbats at the other. We saw this with the NHS bill last year, where the coalition government was absolutely vilified by people in the left talking about how that they were trying to destroy the NHS, which I just do not buy. But equally, like I say, it would be very easy for the current government and, you know, supporters of the current government to point at Labour and say, you were warned about these targets, you were warned that it was going to make hospitals take their eye off the ball and that it could lead to patients not being cared for properly. I mean, and that does seem to be what's happened here. But again, I don't think that's helpful. I do think that there is a structural problem with healthcare in this country and we need to do something about it. I don't have an easy answer, but the idea that we can carry on and in 10, 20, 30, 40 years time, we can still have the NHS in the form that it's in at the moment, given that year on year it is taking up more and more of, you know, GDP, it isn't sustainable. Something has to give in the end. And what I want is for that to happen in a measured way with sensible debate, without people throwing around these terms like you're trying to destroy the NHS, you know, you're trying to privatise it and scaring people into thinking that they're not going to be able to go down to the doctor on Monday and be seen without being charged for it, because that just isn't true. But we don't seem to be able to have a sensible debate about it in this country. I was actually heartened to see the debate across the dispatch box by Cameron and Miliband this time actually was quite measured. And there did seem to be a fair bit of consensus. I just hope that that can be sustained and that at the lower levels within, you know, the shadow cabinet and within, you know, other levels of campaigning, that we can, and, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but try and come together. And I mean, this is a massive issue, you know, that's facing us in the next few decades. How are we going to restructure our health system? It's not going to work properly if both sides are just slinging mud at the other all the time. The Tories can't be trusted on the NHS, so anything the Tories ever try and do or ever try and say about this is just seen as they're just evil, same old Tories. They're trying to destroy our NHS.
And it's our NHS, and you do not understand the way that people on the left feel about the NHS. Take how you feel about AV and how everything, when we have these conversations, everything comes back to AV or electoral reform. If the way that that is central to the core of your politics, that when that's taken away from you, you feel that, physically feel that. That is how the left feel about the NHS. And until you can understand the visceral feelings that we feel about the establishment of the NHS and the pride that the Labour Party takes in establishing that, then you will not understand how to negotiate with us about the NHS. It is our NHS. We're incredibly proud of it.
It's our NHS, Emma. Emma, it's not the Labour Party's NHS. It's our NHS, as in the entire country's NHS.
That's what she means.
Yeah.
She means it's publicly owned.
It's publicly owned, and we want to keep it that way.
Yeah,
I just want to be a bit clear about this, because I think you're being a little bit wishy-washy, I suppose, I feel, Mark, about what the reality is here. Okay, the reality of what's going on here is that this bill is bigger than the initial bill that was written to establish the NHS in the first place. There was no mention of it in either the Tory or the Lib Dems manifesto at all.
No, that's not true. That's not true. There was a big section in the coalition agreement that was talking about devolving power.
Coalition agreement, that's not the same as the manifesto.
No, but the Lib Dem manifesto talked about
this. We didn't vote on the coalition agreement. It's not the same. Let me finish. There was no hint at all that this was going to happen. And in fact, David Cameron in 2009 said there was going to be no top-down reorganisations of the NHS. They came in very, very quickly. They introduced this bill. And if we look at who supports it compared to who is in favour, who is against it, pretty much everybody who has any understanding of the NHS is against it. And very, very few organisations who actually understand anything about the NHS are in favour of it. You know, I just think if you look at like the British Psychological Society, the BMA was against it, the Unison is against it, Royal College of Nursing is against it. You know, anybody who has people who work
patients
in the health
organisations.
Yeah, exactly. Patients' organisations were against it. National Association of Primary Care. I could go on. You know. I could spend all day listing all the organisations that were against it.
And they railroaded over Mark. So how do you negotiate with people who railroad every single person who's telling you this is the wrong thing to do? You don't. So of course people are going to say you're doing the wrong thing and say it louder and louder as people aren't listening to them.
So to try and get a bit of consensus here, because I didn't really realise how strongly I felt about this until this story came out this week, but I guess this must have been bubbling under within me for quite a while. So do you both agree? Maybe we'll go back to Emma, because I've talked quite a lot here. So Emma, what would you do to restructure the NHS so that it is fit for the next 50 years? What would you do?
Well, I'm not a health expert, but I think the difference between what is happening now in the NHS and what happened 100 years ago is that people are living longer and having end-of-life care that takes a lot more effort and a lot more partnership. So I think that bringing together health and care and thinking about that longer term issues, rather than just having people go into hospital and, you know, spend more time in a hospital, which should be a sort of, you know, a place where you go at a particular point in your care, not a place where you go for long term care. I think that's clearly where the emphasis has to shift. And so having an integrated health and care system is where I think that the obvious next step is.
Are you not concerned, though, that the amount of GDP that it's taking at the moment and the projections that are talked about over the next few decades mean that unless there is something structurally done, and I'll repeat, I don't know what, and I'm completely open to debate about this, but I just don't feel it can stay the way it is. Do you think it can stay the way it is?
What's the problem with us putting a little bit of GDP into the
health nation? It's not a little bit, though. That's the problem. It's projected to like double within the next 30 or 40 years or something. And I don't just mean double, you know, as in cash terms. I mean in real terms, in terms of percentage of GDP. And there will come a point, and it's for all the reasons you said, people are living longer, there are more and more treatments out there, and those treatments are more and more expensive. I mean, we already see now that there are some treatments that people want that NICE say, we can't do that. The cost-benefit analysis means that we can't do it. And that's seen as part of the
comparison. There have to be hard-headed decisions made by apolitical organisations like NICE that make those kind of analyses. I think there are two things. First of all, an emphasis on care is actually cheaper than just letting everybody get to emergency point and then go to hospital.
Well, I would definitely
In the long term, you invest to save, which is not something this government's very keen on. It's too Keynesian, it's too, you know, sensible. So you invest in care, you invest in pre-health rather than treating the NHS solely as something that treats people when they get sick. We have a much greater emphasis on a health care system that treats people before they get sick and helps people to not get sick. I think there are lessons we can learn from all over the world about how to run a less expensive per capita health service, and I'd be very happy to look at those lessons and see how we could implement them. But the thing to also remember is that a healthy nation is probably worth a bit of investment.
No, I wouldn't disagree with that. My concern is that without, I use the term restructuring and reform, and I know that gets people's hackles up. So maybe I shouldn't use those terms, but I just don't think that the approach that we take, that we have taken, say, over the last 50 years, will carry us through the next 50 years. I don't think it will. And maybe there'll be technological
advancements. But you say that, that's fine. But that doesn't mean that this reform was the right reform. It wasn't. It was the very, very wrong reform.
Well, OK, but I have to say, and this is where I do start to get a bit more political, I really do genuinely think that any reform that this government had suggested would have been vigorously attacked by the left as a privatisation and as attempting to destroy the NHS.
Well, it's very likely that anything that this government suggested would have been so.
Already you're putting the cart.
No, that is true, though. That's true. You can't deny that. That's true.
You're talking about a bunch of ideologues who don't want...
This government is not hostile to the NHS.
The NHS is a 60-year mistake.
Oliver Letwin in 2008 said that there wasn't going to be an NHS in 5 years under this government.
Look,
Dan Hannan describes it as a 60-year mistake. We're not pretending that this is that this exists. This realm of thinking is prevalent on the right.
Look,
and we are guarding against that. Which I don't have any problem with.
This government, right, I'm in a minority of one in this discussion because there's obviously two people from the left who very, very clearly disagree with me. Well, I'm just going to say this and then I think we need to move on. Well, I'll give you a chance of quick rebuttal and then we'll move on. This government has ring-fenced the NHS budget for the duration of this parliament in a way that Labour weren't going to. So just in that little vignette, that is an example of how this government actually is doing.
Yeah, they'd love to give all that money to Virgin Care.
Well.
Yeah, I also would like to point out that they've also said that the NHS has to make £20 billion worth of saving and told trusts that they need to become foundation trusts by the end of this year. And if they don't, then they're going to go bankrupt.
But that's efficient.
The reality of the NHS on the ground, and you can ask any nurse, any professional working in the NHS at the moment, the reality is cuts. And I wrote this article for The Guardian where I asked NHS professionals to tell me what the reality was like. And the stories that they told me were unbelievable. Stories of hospitals with no clean linen because they couldn't afford it. The idea that the budget, the NHS budget, has been ring-fenced and that means it's going to guard against trusts is just fanciful, to be honest. Well, I wish that was the case, but it's just not.
It is the case. And what they're looking for is efficiency savings within that ring-fenced budget to be fed back in to help with, I guess, what I was talking about, the kind of restructuring of the NHS. Look, we've been on this for quite a long time now, so I think we should probably move on to something that I think I might also have at least a quibble about, which was what people have been calling the bedroom tax, which, before we even begin, I want to question the term bedroom tax, because...
Ever had a problem with the old credit card analogy, Mark? Because I'm sure I've heard you use it.
What credit card analysis?
Yeah, the Labour government maxed out the credit card. Yeah. It's not household budget.
I've never used that term.
I'm sure you haven't.
I haven't because I don't agree with that, because I don't think you can treat the nation like in the same way as you do a household budget. I think Margaret Thatcher was completely wrong about that. There are all kinds of reasons why it doesn't work like that. The term bedroom tax is just a complete misnomer. This is a reduction in benefits. It's not a tax.
It's a reduction in benefits that mean people pay from their own pockets, much like a tax.
Emma, it is not a tax.
It means people have to pay £15 a week simply for having a spare bedroom if they have a husband who they can't share a bed with because their husband is disabled.
It's not a tax,
Emma. All you want about the semantics, but you will sound heartless doing so. It's pointless to try and rename what everybody is calling the bedroom tax. We should get to the substance of it.
We will do in a second, but on previous podcasts...
Yeah, I said before, you can call it the lovely bunch of flowers for all I care.
Okay, but on previous podcasts, Emma, you've pointed out that talking about taking, you know, so many million people out of tax is wrong, because actually it's just income tax. So I'm just trying to be precise about our terms. Okay, so forgetting about the terminology, what's the objection to this then?
Where do you want to start?
Start wherever you want.
Okay, well, the objection could come from many different facets. First of all, it won't work. Its principal objective is twofold, according to the government. First of all, to save money. And second of all, to reallocate the social housing stock better so that people who are currently deemed to be under-occupying their homes move into smaller flats so that people who are in need of larger homes can move into the larger homes that the people who were currently under-occupying we're living in. Now, there are two principal reasons that this won't work. First of all, the smaller homes that people need to move into don't exist. That's quite a big objection to get over. They don't exist within social stock. So what will happen is that those people who literally cannot afford to stay in their homes will move into the private rented sector. Their housing benefit will actually go up, even though they will be getting within the smaller flats. And so it won't save any money either. But you will have broken the link between people and their social homes, which is really what the main objection is. That's what you're really trying to do. Okay. When you look at the government's own impact assessment of this, they reckoned that about 85% of people who were hit by the bedroom tax would stay in their homes and would find the extra 15, 25, 40 pounds a week from their heating and eating budgets. Their impact assessment said these people will pay. These people who can't afford to pay. And we've all seen the horrific stories of people being forced from the homes that they lived in all their lives, brought up their children in, saw their partners die in. And people who are, two-thirds of whom are disabled, people whose kids have gone off to fight wars for us are losing their homes because their kids are not living there anymore. And it's quite, quite ridiculous. It doesn't do any of the things the government says it's going to do.
Okay, Ellie, do you want to add something?
Yeah, I was just going to say, did you see the open letter in the Mirror today? It was absolutely heartbreaking. The lady whose husband died of cancer, and now she has a condition as well. I can't remember what it is, but she scattered her ashes in her husband's ashes in her back garden, and they didn't have any children. So the only social contact she has is with her neighbours who help her with her shopping. And now she's expected to leave her house because she's been hit by the bedroom tax, because she still has a spare room from when her husband was alive. And I mean, really, it's just unbelievable what's happening to people like her, that, you know, to think that she'll have to leave her husband's ashes in a rose bush that she planted for him in the garden, and all the social contacts she has, to go and move into this smaller house that doesn't even exist. I mean, this tax, I mean, if you want to take all of the cruelty elements out of it, it's just utterly nonsensical. It's ridiculous. It was like it was invented by people who've never even lived in this country. You know, I mean, it's crazy. I can't believe that they could come up with something so wrong-headed.
Okay, so we've got consensus between both of you again. My view on this is that I actually don't think that the government should be doing this in this way, and I don't think they should be doing it now either. I agree that there seem to be a lot of side effects from this that are, shall we say, undesirable. Obviously, you've mentioned some of the anecdotal stories that we've heard. I'm sure there'll be more as well. I just don't think this is helpful, and I think it, from a political perspective, it does help to play into this idea that, you know, the government is being cruel to, you know, the poorest members of society. So I don't think that's right. Having said that, in principle, I don't have a problem with trying to more efficiently distribute the housing that is available. But I agree with you that the idea that you're going to be taking benefits away from people or reducing people's benefits in an attempt to try and get them to move into other house, smaller houses, when those houses don't exist, is stupid. That really is stupid. This should have been done in a way, you know, either it was delayed until the houses were built, or something should have been changed about this to make it work. Because I think you're right, I think it won't work, and I think what it will do is reduce benefits for people who really need them. Having said that, I'll say two other things. The first thing is that the government has put in measures to try and help the most needy who are affected by these. So they haven't done nothing. It probably isn't going to be enough, and I'm sure even if it was enough, because that's people are going to have to go and apply for it and all the rest of it, that ends up more difficult. But what I wanted to ask was, because Emma, you seem to have two objections, that it wouldn't work, but in principle, do you agree that a more efficient use of the housing stock is actually better for everyone if it could be executed in a way that would work? So in the longer term, if there was a way of doing this, even if it meant people might have to move, because you said about people who've lived in a certain house for many years, but I think I've discussed this with you before, that people in the private sector don't have that privilege. If they need to move because economic circumstances or other circumstances, like job move or whatever, they have to move. So in principle, do you not think that redistributing the housing stock in a more efficient way is actually a desirable thing to try and achieve, if possible, if it would work?
Well, there are two things. First of all, I would massively change the rights and that people have in the private rented sector.
Yeah, me too.
We have an insane private rented sector that doesn't give people any kind of security of tenure, any kind of security of rent. So I don't think we should say, as David Cameron did during PMQs, and as you were intimating just now, oh, well, people in the private rented sector have it bad on this element, so socially, people in social rented housing should have it bad too. I just don't like that race to the bottom element of this. But when you talk about the efficient distribution of housing, there are several different factors you have to think about. It is not just about the size of the units, not least because quite a lot of the social housing we have was built after the war when family sizes were very different. So actually, people who are managing these the social housing do so in a particular way. A lot of housing associations, for example, in some areas would have a deliberate strategy of putting people into properties where they would underoccupy, so they didn't have a huge amount of families of children with the same age all growing up in a massively small space, because that causes huge social problems. So when you're talking about the management of properties, you aren't just talking about how to use each individual unit effectively. You're talking about how to build effective communities that work together and are coherent. So it's not just a case of saying, if I can put family Robinson in a two-bedroom house, and I can put family Smith in a five-bedroom house, and I can put family Jones in a three-bedroom house, everything will be fine. It's actually saying, well, what happens when family Smith, Robinson and Jones are all put in together, and would it be actually better if family Robinson were put into this other area, and nice single Mrs. Miggins actually lived in that house there, because then she, you've got a nice mixed community with people of different ages.
There's an excellent range of surnames there, Emma. I'm quite impressed.
I had to go a little Blackadder.
Yeah, I did notice the dip into Blackadder there. I understand what you're saying, Emma, that it's not a totally straightforward situation. But we have a situation at the moment where there are, for want of a better word, spare, in quotes, rooms in houses. And I know in some cases they're not spare. I mean, I've read stories. I've read stories about, you know, people who are disabled who need the spare, in quotes, room for their equipment. And, you know, I know that
fathers with kids come to stay in them over the weekend. Foster parents who haven't yet got a child. Yeah.
People whose families are in Iraq.
Fine. Absolutely. And there's all of those. But there will be some rooms that are spare out of this. I mean, deciding exactly which ones are and which ones aren't is sounds like a bit of a Sisyphean task, to be honest, but assuming that there are families who currently can't be housed, who are put in bed and breakfast because there aren't enough houses. So if there was a more efficient use of the existing housing stock, more families would be housed. So you do recognise that, presumably, that if we could, actually, there might be a greater good. And I appreciate that it's going to be very, very difficult to work out who goes where, and there could be problems with that. But if we could free up several hundred thousand pounds.
I think the numbers of people who actually genuinely are under-occupying in the way that we're talking about, we're not talking about very many people. We're not talking necessarily about people who live in the same places that the houses, the people who are looking for housing, are actually living. It's quite intricate where people live and where people are under-occupying, not always the same thing. For example, a lot of the people who are going to be hit by the under-occupation penalty live in the north, and actually a lot of the housing need is in the south. So it's actually a lot more complicated than that. The answer, of course, is the answer that I come back to time and time again. It's
build
like
more houses.
UNAV, build more blooming houses.
Yeah, and couldn't agree more.
That is ultimately what we have to do, what we must do. Build more houses, make the private rented sector work better for the people living in it, and build more houses of every different kind of tenure. Make sure that people can stay in their homes for life, well, whatever type of tenure they're living in, if that's what they choose to do and if that's what they want to do.
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree with that. And we talked about security of tenure in the private sector a few weeks ago, which is something that used to be particularly close to my heart because I was affected by it. I mean, I'm not anymore, but yeah, I completely agree with that. OK, so I think that's all we've got time for. So I'd just like to thank, as usual, Emma.
Thank you, Mark.
And also like to thank our guest tonight, Ellie May O'Hagan. Thank you very much, Ellie.
Thank you for having me.
No problem. It's been great. Hopefully we'll get you back on again at some point.
Absolutely.
And I'd also like to thank Audio Boo, who hosts the podcast. And I'd also like to thank Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com, who provides our theme music. And illnesses aside, hopefully we will be back next week.